and we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really honored to be sitting opposite Dr. Richard Sjerdsma, who for a long, long time was a very important force of nature in the music department at Carthage College, a member of the faculty there for a number of years. He began teaching at Carthage 50 years ago, 1968, and he retired in 2007. So he was there for a number of decades, including decades of tremendous growth for the music department. So he presided over some very important years for the department as department chair. And also for much of his time during Carthage, also a very busy concert soloist and recitalist, and did a great deal of performing in Europe, has spent a number of years also as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Singing, which is a very prestigious scholarly journal for voice teachers across the country. So Dr. Sjerdsma's career in music and higher academia has been a distinguished one, to the extent that Carthage College is going to be honoring him in a very special way this coming weekend during its homecoming festivities, in a couple of different ways that we will talk about a little later in the hour. But we want to especially mention the special way in which the homecoming concert Saturday night is very much designed as a tribute to Dr. Sjerdsma and his career. And it will include a performance that he will deliver with the wind orchestra as narrator of Sir William Walton's Facade, and two of Dr. Sjerdsma's most important former voice students who have gone on to professional careers will be back at Carthage and singing that night. So it's going to be a great evening of music and a great way to honor Dr. Sjerdsma and all that he means to Carthage, his colleagues there, and the many students that were under his tutelage during his long time there, including my wife, Kathy, one of many voice students who profited from having him as a teacher. So I think that's enough glowing accolades for the introduction. It's time to start talking. We welcome you, Dr. Richard Sjerdsma, to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. I'm not sure I recognize the person that you introduced. I feel like I should go out and rent a tux maybe and come back.
No, your sweatshirt will be just fine.
The force of nature has revised my thinking about myself considerably.
In the best sense of the word. So, first of all, what I envision this as much as anything is for people who even already know who you are and a lot about why you have been important to Carthage, certainly might not know too much about who you are in terms of where you come from, and also a little bit about when and how music first became really important to you. So before we get to all that you did at Carthage, I hope you won't mind taking us through some of those earliest years that I understand were spent in the beautiful state of Michigan.
Yeah, I tell everyone who will listen, whose numbers decrease daily, that I'm a recovering Calvinist. I was born and raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and a product of not only the Dutch Reformed Church, but also a Christian education all the way from kindergarten through undergraduate college. I'm a graduate of Calvin College. And my siblings, I'm the youngest of six, and my dad sang and enjoyed singing a lot. I felt that I couldn't match what they had done. After all, my dad was in a male quartet of his brothers. The Sjerdsma Quartet was quite notorious in the Grand Rapids area. I didn't really seriously consider myself a musician. I got excited about music, though, in high school when, during my senior year, we had a hotshot new choir director who got me involved in a male quartet. That finished not only high school together, but we went all the way through college, and we toured.
Wow.
During the summer of 1960, the West Coast and the Canadian provinces, singing almost every night.
Singing what kinds of things?
Spiritual music, sacred music. These were in our denominational churches, by and large.
So this is not a barbershop quartet by any stretch.
No, although we did sing barbershop. We won a couple of things there, too. So that determined my my major in college, and my initial goal was to be a music teacher, and I was a choir director in a denominational high school in the middle of South Dakota for 3 years. I taught not only choir and music appreciation, but U.S. history, world history, American literature, English literature, speech, geography, and I directed the school play on a couple of occasions.
Oh, my gosh. So how large a school was this?
100 souls.
All together. Wow.
And I had a choir of 50.
Wow.
And these kids could sing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes in those small Midwestern schools, you really have a exciting spirit in the air, and everybody does a little bit of everything, and it can be really quite exciting. And it sounds from the way you describe it that this was the prairie with a capital P.
It was. It was still rattlesnake country, and just north of the little town where we lived, one could still see the ruts of the wagon trains.
Wow. So something took you from New Holland, South Dakota, to Ohio State University. How did that opportunity come your way, or did you seek it out?
I talk a lot about, and have written in my editor's commentary in the journal, about forks in the road. As I mentioned, I was involved in music education, and while teaching in South Dakota, simultaneously, I took classes and spent my summers at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion, and got my master's degree there in voice, actually. I had a voice teacher, his name was Frank Strime. Didn't have a particularly beautiful voice himself, but what he had, he knew how to use well and knew how to communicate. And he got me moving a bit more in that direction. At that time, everybody and his brother and sister were getting master's degrees, so I thought, well, I had a job opportunity to teach in another high school in Muskegon, Michigan at that time, which would have brought me close back to my family, or to go on and get an advanced degree. And I chose the latter. I got a teaching fellowship at Ohio State University and went there to enter the program for a PhD in music education. And I began that coursework, during which time, very early on, I took a course in medieval notation, you know, where you have all these dots and scribbles and lines without any much relationship at all to what we see on the printed page today. And it was just fascinating, and it was so well taught by Richard Hoppen, a medieval specialist. And he he inspired me to change my focus to musicology, and this is awful. The rest, they say, is history. Sorry. Okay.
But I'm laughing. So. No, it really, that's really true. And one of the things I'm thinking about is what that experience was like compared to just a year or two earlier when you're in New Holland, South Dakota. It's just amazing to think about the way in which a whole nother world opened up to you.
I can remember the day after we moved to Columbus, Ohio, and got ensconced in our little apartment, that I took a walk on campus. It was on a Sunday morning, I think, before the semester had begun. And I found myself in front of the football stadium.
Ah.
And I was just standing there in awe and thinking, This has got to be the center of the world.
Wow. So you mentioned that there was the possibility of this new teaching opportunity that would have put you back in Michigan and close to home, close to your family. But it sounds like that did not materialize. Instead, an opportunity materializes at a place you'd probably scarcely heard of, Carthage College.
Yeah.
So how did that happen?
It changed my life. I weighed the potential of teaching in a high school, a denominational high school, for 40 more years and getting a gold watch and then put out to pasture, or challenging myself with an advanced degree, and I chose the latter. That another fork in the road. As I continued my musicological studies, and I still use them to this day. I'm fascinated by research. Again, I was given a teaching fellowship in voice and opera. So I was teaching undergraduate voice students, and my own teacher had a debilitating stroke in the summer of 1967, and I was asked to take over his teaching studio, which included master's degrees. I was 26 years old.
Wow.
And master's degree students and the rest. But that particular fork in the road then led me in the direction of voice pedagogy. I was perfectly content up to that time to be ensconced in a university ivory tower someplace and doing musicological research and teaching music history and the like. And this moved me in that direction. The next fork, if I may go on with my dining utensil analogy here, came at the end of my stay, my three-year stay in Columbus, when I was offered a position at Clarion College in Clarion, Pennsylvania, and Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I of course, took the Carthage road. Hmm.
That's 50 years ago, by the way, that you began teaching there. So it's, as you said earlier, it's kind of serendipity that this honor comes from Carthage, that I'm not sure they consciously had in mind this half-century mark since you began teaching there. But there's a whole lot to celebrate. What was Carthage like at the time that you began teaching there in 1968? And I'm thinking in a couple of different respects. I mean, in terms of sort of the size of the school, the scope of its reach, and also what life was like in our country at the time that you began teaching there.
I don't know the exact enrollment in 1968. I think it was close to 1,000, and President Harold Lintz and the Board of Trustees had determined that we would cap enrollment at 1,200. We would never get any larger than that. The school itself was a hidden gem. I was really impressed by some of the large intellects that I met during my early years at Carthage, and how they influenced my life. I think, for example, of Bill Miller and Jim Bishop, who had a vocabulary that just wouldn't quit. The same year that I came, Sam Chell and Alan Houck, both highly intelligent professors, came as well. And it was just really a strong, closely knit intellectual community, a very stimulating environment. Mm. That having been said, I must admit that the music department was not much. It was rather weak, small, and good people teaching, but it just was struggling. And frankly, during my first few years here, I was not particularly interested in staying. Hmm. And I had put quite a few job applications out, put myself back into the market, had a number of opportunities that I didn't think were worth pursuing. But I think in my fourth year, another fork in the road. I was offered a position at Jacksonville University in Florida as a teacher of voice and director of the opera program. At the same time, the chair of the Department of Music at Carthage, who was not granted tenure, was leaving the faculty, and I was asked to take over as department chair. I was 30 years old.
Wow.
And there being no other PhD or no other doctorate at that time, I guess they were stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another fork in the road, and I chose to stay and see what I could do with the department.
And do you remember, I know that was a long time ago, but do you remember anything about exactly what you weighed or how you weighed those two possibilities? I mean, was there anything in particular that led you to choose what you did, to make the choice you did, to stay at Carthage?
I'm sure glad you added words to the sentence after weighed. Because I would hate to tell you what I weighed at that time. I think, basically, it was an opportunity that I saw to put a stamp on the Department of Music and see what I could do to make it grow and develop and work toward a vision that I had for the department.
Hmm. We should probably add that when you started at Carthage in 1968, Carthage had not been in Kenosha all that long, less than a decade. So just in general, the school was probably still experiencing, I don't know what to call it, kind of growing pains or the kind of still a period of adjustment to this brand new home, this brand new campus and so on. And so it doesn't surprise me a bit that the music department, probably among others, was struggling. And there's something about a music department. When a music department is small, you really have a problem. It's hard to function in the way that we think of with a music department.
Yeah, and that struggle for identity was not only internal, but external as well. Here we were, the interlopers into the Kenosha community, and stuck over here on a hill on the bluffs north of town a little bit, and we didn't have a whole lot of recognition in that regard. And also, the Kenosha music program, the school music program, was very, very strong and very, very well known. And frankly, the attitude was, we don't need the music over there. We've got a good thing going right here.
Plenty of music already.
Oh, yeah.
So you faced some interesting challenges, but obviously met them very, very well. And I suppose part of what you must be proud of is that you must have had a hand in some important people coming aboard the faculty who helped make a difference as the department began to grow.
Yeah, there's pain, too. I think about these people that I had to tell I would not recommend for continuation. And, you know, I think about those, and I don't regret the decisions as decisions, but I do regret the personal pain that was involved.
Right. I guess that's something inescapable if you're going to be an effective department chair, is there are difficult decisions and choices that have to be made, and they have to be made more than anything for the well-being of the department itself and the students the department is serving.
Right.
I know that one of the things that happened before we get to that, so you are doing all of this as a relative newcomer as a voice teacher. I mean, you really don't have years of experience behind you. I mean, not as many years behind you as someone else might who had kind of made a concerted effort to study to do this. It really kind of fell into your lap almost accidentally. What were you like early on as a voice teacher before you had, in a sense, established yourself and gained the experience that, I mean, most of us who know you as a voice teacher, you're just sort of we feel dwarfed in terms of all that you've experienced. But once upon a time, you were a newcomer to this. What were you like as a young and inexperienced voice teacher? Were you still something like the voice teacher that you ultimately became in terms of your approach and style and so on?
Oh, approach and style, perhaps. But one of the vagaries of youth is a lack of introspection, I think. But from this vantage point, I tend to view it as I do my own kids, my own daughters, that I wish I knew then what I know now. But I think that I always had a very good rapport with students, and I think they responded well to the kinds of approaches and the kinds of music that we made together. In terms of knowledge of anatomy and physiology and pedagogic techniques and that and related ideas, that of course all matures as one grows into one's profession. But I think essentially my approach has been, you are an individual voice. And I need to approach you as a unique person and a unique voice that is unlike any of your peers, any of my other students, and to deal with you on that basis.
And I know that I think one of the things that has always intrigued me about you as a teacher is how you would establish this really strong personal connection with your students, I mean, who had nicknames for you, and you know, there would be plenty of laughter in the halls and so on. And yet, you were also a taskmaster, not afraid to say the harsh, not necessarily harsh, but the difficult things that sometimes have to be said when a student is not working or messing around or making poor decisions or whatever. And that's not easy to do. I mean, that's almost easier to do when you haven't made a strong personal connection and you don't care if your student likes you or not. That's quite beside the point. But yeah. I was always intrigued that your relationships with your students was a very powerfully personal one, and yet that personal connection did not prevent you from saying difficult things when they needed to be said.
And if the student knows that you love him or her as a person and a fellow human being, creature of God, then that person also knows when you are a taskmaster that you have his or her best interests at heart.
Good point. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Sjerdsma. He began teaching at Carthage College in 1968. He retired from there in 2007. So obviously he was there for a long, long time. And it's even more than a decade after his retirement, it's hard to even think about the music department without him. He was a very important figure there and instrumental in its tremendous growth over the years. And he is being honored this coming weekend at Carthage's homecoming festivities in a couple of ways that we'll talk about before the hour is out. So Dr. Sjerdsma, I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about one thing that was a real hallmark of your career as a tenor, as a recitalist, as a concert artist, although you did plenty of performing here. I always think of you as someone who did an enormous amount of performance in Europe. And I wonder if you could take us back to when that began and also say a word about what that meant to you, those experiences working and concertizing in Europe.
I had been to a two-month study program called AIMS in Graz, Austria, in 1971, and the focus was on Lieder, German art song, and opera, performing for agents and seeing if they were interested in hiring you for their various opera houses and the like. That was my first experience in Europe, and I learned some German along the way. And nothing long range came of that particular experience. That is, in terms of my relocating to Germany, it certainly was an enriching experience. But about two or three years later, in the I think it was the summer of 1974, we were having another. Carthage was having another of its summer organ seminars that Bill Roth managed. He had engaged an organist, church musician, composer from Hanover, Germany, whose name was Matthias Kern, to come as guest artists for that event. For some reason, Bill could not meet Matthias at the airport in Milwaukee, and he asked me, because I could speak some German, to meet the gentleman, take him back to campus, address his various needs, and I did. Matthias and I then became friends for the rest of his life, and he died maybe I think 3 years ago now, at 85. He was a well-known composer in Germany. And also a choir director. He directed the Kantoreigemeinschaft Hannover in Germany. And it happened that he was planning a tour with his choir of northern Germany and Sweden, and he invited me in 1975 to accompany the choir as a tenor soloist. I did, performed as soloist in a number of cities in both countries, and then began to make a few more contacts. That began to snowball, and over the years then, and each time I went back, I would meet more people, and that would open more doors. So over the years, I think I made 22 concert tours, wow. Solo concert tours of basically Germany, but sometimes in Sweden. I sang in Budapest when it was still under communist control. In France, and in Austria, of course.
Wow. Typically, what did you sing on those recitals?
I sang some oratorio with German orchestras. I did a couple of orchestral stints as a soloist in, for example, the B minor Mass in Hanover. Hmm. But I think, by and large, my repertoire was rather equally divided between sacred music concerts in various languages, German, Latin, Italian, English, in a number of cathedrals throughout Europe, some really impressive edifices, and also concerts of American art song. I did one German Lieder concert in Hanover and in Germany. That was in Wolfenbüttel, I guess. But that makes no sense. I mean, why should a German come here and sing American art song any more than I should go to Germany and sing Lieder? So that was a one time experiment that I never repeated.
So what do you remember most fondly about just the experience of doing so much performing in Europe?
The people. The places. May I tell you a little anecdote?
Sure.
I was in Hannoversmünden, which is between Kassel and Hanover, singing, working with an orchestra and chorus, and we did a Bach, a CPE Bach oratorio in a cathedral in I forget the name of the town. It was on the tip of my tongue. At any rate, it was an old 11th century cathedral with about a 22nd reverb in the middle of nowhere. And we rehearsed in the afternoon, and then there was this gap between the end of the rehearsal and the concert itself. Well, there was a little kneipe, a little bar, restaurant, in the bend of the road near the cathedral, and I walked there for a bite to eat before the concert. Well, these were the days when men, think of Sammy Davis Jr., would wear chains around their neck with various symbols on them. Well, I had a Jewish star, and it was just a Jewish star. I mean, that was something that I wore regularly. Well, the farmers came in from the fields as I was eating my small dinner at this little bar, and they saw that star, and they went after me. And they were using some pretty rough Plattdeutsch language.
Wow.
And they were ready to get physically violent until the bartender had to step in.
Wow.
And this probably was 1977 or so. At that time, there was just particularly in the countryside a lot of anti-Semitism and prejudice and bias.
Wow.
Remaining.
So you saw a little of everything.
A little of everything.
Wow.
Yeah. But basically, that was one of the very, very few bad experiences. The other thing I remember is that in these cathedrals, you can't warm up any place. I mean, there's the sacristy, which is right next to the congregation. But so in many of them, I would either go out to my rented car and try to sing a few notes. I'd walk outside and put a towel around my face and sing into the towel.
So there's no Sunday school wing
to go
find a room. Yeah, interesting. Well, how terrific that you had so many great experiences, and then also in turn were able to bring your friend Matthias Kern back to Carthage on a number of different occasions. So very good. You have stood in front of some choirs over the years as well. Can you just say a word about what this experience has meant to you, and maybe give our listeners a sense of what you have done in that respect?
You mean as conductor?
Right.
Oh, okay. I began conducting choirs when I was 17 years old.
Wow.
That was my first year of college. And that's what I intended to do for a living, be a choir director in a high school someplace. It was money. I was paying my own tuition, and it was a job. So I had two church choirs virtually every year while I was at Calvin. Of course, they don't sing every Sunday. I couldn't have managed that. But we had two services, one in the morning and one in the evening, and I was able to juggle with that. Do you know the name Ken Miedema?
Oh yes, I do.
And
a great blind composer and Christian singer.
Yeah. When I was a sophomore, I think I had the Alpine Avenue Christian Reformed Church Choir. And there was Ken Miedema. He was a high school student at the time, and his mother, who sang in my choir.
Oh, you've told me this. It's been a long, long time.
May I repeat it?
Yes, it's a great story.
And we were rehearsing the Brahms "How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place" from the Requiem, and Ken, who of course is blind, was sitting in the tenor section, and during a pause he waved his hand, and I said, "Yes, Ken." And he said, "Doesn't Brahms remind you of mashed potatoes?" And I said, "Yes, I guess he does, Ken." But as you mentioned, Ken went on to be a very great composer. Oh, and Ken also played piano for my my kids' choir. I had the kids' choir there, and before I even started the first rehearsal, I said to Ken, "How are you going to know the music?" He said, "Play this piece for me." So I did, and he had it perfectly, note perfect from there on. And I said, "Okay, well, that's one thing. How are you going to know my attacks?" He said, "Breathe." And he could hear my breath, and he was spot on every time.
Wow. Very, very good.
Thing. But the directing of choirs in general has been something that I've continued up to this time, and I find it very rewarding to work communally to make good, meaningful music together, and particularly in the ministry of the church.
Right. So there at St. Mary's Lutheran Church, where you and your wife Mary belong, and I know your German men's chorus has meant a great deal to you as well. What is their name again?
The Männergesangverein Canosche.
There it is.
Or MGV, I guess, is handier.
Something else that has kept you very busy over the years, and I know has meant a great deal to you, is the work that you have done for the Journal of Singing. So it's not a periodical you're likely to see on the shelf at Barnes & Noble, but to music teachers across the country, it means a great deal. It's the official scholarly journal of NATS, the National Association of Teachers of Singing, and you were its book reviewer for more than a quarter century. And then back in 2001, became its editor-in-chief. We don't have time to go into it in great detail, but I would love to have you just give our listeners just even the vaguest sense of what kind of responsibility this is and the kind of work that you are doing all year long on the Journal of Singing.
Well, I guess the best way to do it is to cite Harry Truman's sign on his desk, "The buck stops with me." I have 13 regular contributors, of among whom, of course, is Greg Berg, who manages the Listener's Gallery column, and each of these persons contributes his and her column for every issue of the journal. In addition to that, try to publish three or four feature articles that I select among those that are unsolicitedly sent to me by various people throughout the world, actually, particularly Western Europe and the United States. These manuscripts that come to me as for consideration as feature articles are sent to a peer review board, who offer their evaluations, although the final decision, of course, is mine. So from this material, for every issue, I assemble a master manuscript, which I edit. I edit each piece carefully, and then I submit it to my graphics artist in Fulton, Missouri, who puts it in page format, incorporating, of course, all of my edits, returns it to me for and to the contributors for the first round of proofs. So I proof that round. Then it is sent back to me with the ads in it. I proof that round. And then I, from the printing company, I get the final blue lines, which represents the journal exactly how it will look upon a publication. And that's my final opportunity for proofing or finding any errors, and then it's on to the printer. So by the time it comes out, I don't want to read it again.
Well, you just spoiled my funny question, which was going to be, and you think this is fun, or this gives you pleasure?
For a lot of the
process, I think it does. I know it does.
Yeah, it does, and I'm sure Sigmund would have a great deal of fun analyzing that. But,
Well, it's been great to see what you have done with the Journal of Singing, and whenever we gather for our national conventions every other year, it's really interesting to hear the chorus of praise from various voice teachers across the country who have nothing but praise for the way in which the Journal of Singing has become an even more revered journal and more scholarly in its approach and so on. And you are the taskmaster making sure that it attains that standard.
Well, that's good to hear. I don't hear much feedback. I don't know if people are reluctant to tell the guy that does all this or what. But that's okay. So I'm glad to hear information like this. In a way, to go back to why I took over the Department of Music, the feeling is the same. Because, you know, I had the opportunity to take this journal and put my own stamp on it.
That you have. So, Carthage College, as we mentioned at the outset, is going to be honoring you this weekend at homecoming in a very, very special way, in a couple of different ways. One of the things that they are doing in recognition for all that you have done for Carthage in a lot of different ways is that your office, I forget what your room, 131?
131.
Yeah, Johnson Art Center, 131. Will now bear your name for all time to come. And so there, that will be a small ceremony that will occur Saturday afternoon. There will be a special dinner in your honor at which a number of different former students have been welcomed back and former colleagues. And I believe an anniversary for Lambda Kappa is being celebrated, which is an important part of your legacy too as well, right?
Right. Steve Smith and I began that.
That would be the musical, I don't know if you call it a fraternity, the Greek organization supporting the work of young music students there. And then the crowning event is Saturday night's homecoming concert at Carthage, in which you're going to play a very important role, and much of that concert is crafted with you as special honoree. And I know one of the things that excites you a great deal is that two of your most distinguished former voice students are going to be performing Saturday night. Tell us about William Watson and Dean Peterson.
Okay, Dean is a former student of mine, and he's a bass baritone. He came to a professional singing a little bit later than most in his life, but he actually sang at the Metropolitan Opera, and I think he made his debut as the king in Verdi's Aida. But he also stepped in for Sam Raimi, arguably the world's best-known bass, as Mephistopheles in Gounod's Faust. So Dean has had quite a career.
And came to Carthage on a football scholarship, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, and so it's, singing kind of made its way surprisingly into his life, but boy, it's a good thing it did.
And he also sang for my retirement concert 11 years ago. I'm glad to have him back. Bill Watson is a very fine tenor, and he studied all 4 years with me at Carthage. He is a what I call a Bach tenor, a light lyric, very lovely sound, and he has made a very fine reputation for himself in the Chicago area particularly, and specifically has done a lot of work with the Bach choir.
Marvelous.
I'm sorry, music of the Baroque is what they are called.
So that will be fun to have, in a sense, two very different singers, both very, very fine, but of two different ilks, as they say.
And Bill is bringing his wife along, and the two of them are doing a canticle by Benjamin Britten called Abraham and Isaac. And my daughter Rhonda and I have sung that on a number of occasions.
For goodness sake.
That'll be a nice...
Fantastic. And then I know something else that... pleases you very much is that one of Carthage's finest musical alums, Tom Vigneri, originally from Kenosha, has been commissioned to compose some music that will receive its world premiere Saturday night.
May I just say that it blows me away what the college is doing? I mean, I don't feel that I deserve this. The people that walk through my doors deserve that recognition. They have asked Tom to commission, or they have commissioned a piece from Tom, and are flying him down here for its premiere at this concert. In preparation, Tom asked me to suggest some poems that have meant a lot to me over the years. That was difficult to do because there are so many. But I gave him about four to select from, and he has composed a piece for tenor and piano that employ two of them. And Bill Watson will premiere that on Saturday night. That's going to be a big deal.
And then, as if all that wasn't enough, you're also going to be serving as narrator for a very special piece. Tell our listeners about William Walton's Facade.
William Walton's Facade is a lot of fun, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. it is based on poetry by Edith Sitwell, and Edith Sitwell can be a very heady, deep composer. I've sung some of her stuff, and it's not easy. Here, she is capricious beyond recognition, almost. She's put together poems that are really kind of sassy. They don't make a whole lot of sense. They capitalize on words. She is fascinated with rhyme, with alliteration, onomatopoeia, assonance, and just how things fit together. And she's composed a whole set of poetry that William Walton then has set to music. I would warn anyone who tries to listen, don't take it seriously. Don't try to make sense out of it. I mean, for example, do not take a bath in Jordan, Gordon, on this holy Sabbath, on this peaceful day, said the huntsman playing on his old bagpipe. That doesn't make any sense, but it sure is a lot of fun to say.
Very good. So we are so excited that that will also be a part of Saturday night's festivities. So this concert is Saturday evening, 7:30 in Siebert Chapel. The concert is free and open to the public, and the Carthage Choir will also be performing some wonderful pieces as well. So it's going to be a big, big weekend for Dr. Richard Searsman. I understand you have a lot of family that are going to be on hand for it.
Some. Mary, of course. My daughter Rhonda and two of her children, Adam and Rachel, and Mary's daughter Lori and her husband. So yeah, it'll be a good family time.
Great, great, and certainly some students and colleagues and others from Carthage, past and present, on hand to join in the accolades for you, all deserved despite your protestations to the contrary. So, Dr. Richard Searsman, it's been great to catch up with you and for me to learn even some things I didn't know about how life has transpired for you. And I'm certainly glad that Carthage is doing this on your behalf. And we certainly encourage anyone listening today to come and enjoy and experience the festivities this weekend at Carthage's Homecoming. Thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you. It's been a privilege and fun.
Glad you could be here. Tomorrow on the morning show,